Hi everyone, you're listening to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. This show is all about building a hub of relevant, insightful and actionable business insights that can help drive greater performance and innovation. I've worked with several tech startups myself and know from experience that success is underpinned by a passion for continual learning and growth. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to speak with our guests and learn from their stories. If you enjoy this podcast, you can download the free ebook featuring my personal podcast highlights from the past 2 years at www.venturi-group.com/podcast-ebook. If you're looking for more information on today's episode, just head over to the Venturi website to check out the show notes. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Greg Jarrett, Head of UX at William Hill.
So a little bit of background about myself. Obviously, my name is Greg Jarrett, and I am currently head of UX for William Hill. I started my career as a visual designer. Went to art school and kind of did a degree in visual design or graphic design, as it was called in those days, and did quite a lot of work below the line and in sort of traditional design print media. And gradually over the years, I've kind of evolved into digital online. And then, you know, also evolved from, you know, being more of a visual designer into, someone who's quite interested in kind of UX side of design, and have gradually kind of got more and more experience and, you know, developed my knowledge in that area, as the years have kind of gone on. The other thing that's quite interesting, you know, a lot of people of my kind of, age have come through a similar route where, you know, the early days of the web, you know, when the web first kind of kicked off, the early days of web design, designers basically did everything, including what was called information architecture in the good old days. And information architecture, you know, was all about, you know, creating, you know, wireframes for the sites, doing very basic site maps. And that was kind of the birth of, you know, UX as it's kind of recognized today.
Fantastic, mate. Yeah. And, well, I suppose, you know, one of the things that I'm always curious to know about is how, and I suppose you kind of answered it, but was how UX has kind of changed over the years. Like you say, it has evolved quite dramatically in the 20 years that kind of you've been involved.
Yeah. It sounds like a long time when you say it like that. I suppose a couple of answers to that. So first thing is, you know, pure UX people who actually have been doing it for a very long time will argue that it's been around for ages. You know, it's been around for 30 years, you know, because there was always, you know, human-centered design as a kind of a practice. But its application, you know, more in digital products is fairly new. And I think it's kind of evolved from, you know, originally, as I said, you know, it started off literally it was wireframes in a sitemap. And that was kind of done because designers needed those schematics in order to complete the design work, you know, figure out what the menu structure was. And that gradually evolved into, as I said earlier, you know, information architecture, which was really looking at information hierarchy, how sites and things would be structured so that people could find the information easily and it would make sense. And then that also then evolved into more user experience design. And I think, I suppose one of the catalysts for user experience design, would have been, you know, the whole, you know, design thinking approach and human centered design as a kind of a discipline. And that was really looking at, you know, really trying to understand users and, you know, getting their input in helping to kind of co-create products. You know, originally when design, you know, visual design was kind of in its infancy for digital media, quite often the designers, you had this kind of concept of rock star designers, and they were designers who kind of had all the answers, you know, had really strong opinions on things, and needed to kind of sell the ideas and the designs into clients or into stakeholders. And that whole kind of approach has kind of evolved quite a lot. And there's a kind of a parallel in UX as well. You know, originally, UX design is all about, you know, creating wireframes, schematics, and putting it all together. It's evolved into much more of a research-based discipline now, and it's much more about getting users' input into the work rather than just having the right answers. And so I often say to, you know, the guys on my team and people I work with, you know, the role of a UX designer is all about facilitation, you know, having the right tools to get the answers, not necessarily knowing what the answers are. And I think historically it would have been, you know, UX designer would be expected to know the answers and they would create some wireframes. And I think increasingly people are looking at, the concept of applying the scientific method to discover what the right answer is. The scientific method being, you come up with a hypothesis, our users, in order to solve this problem for our users, our hypothesis is doing blah, blah, blah will be a good solution. And then you kind of validate that through whatever means, either prototyping or user testing, or you may even just build the product and use that as a validation. So it's quite a new, it's not new, so it's quite a different approach, trying to validate something rather than just going on your gut feel and best practice. It's a much better way of doing things. You end up with much stickier products and products that are much more successful because you actually really get into the heart of what people want rather than basing your design solution on an individual designer's aesthetic or point of view. It's definitely a better way of doing things.
Yeah, 100% agree. It was my experiences with UX. After I moved on to a different company that had kind of a UX UI team, their kind of responsibilities kind of crossed over quite a bit into kind of on-site and kind of optimization work. And obviously, a lot of the optimization work was kind of based on user feedback and obviously collaborating with kind of data as well. To kind of identify any trends and then obviously go based on that, make the adjustments. And it was fantastic because then I went on to obviously collaborate a lot with them and, some really super smart people from kind of the UX space, who had that kind of nice combination of the design capabilities, but still kind of an analytical scientific way of thinking. And I thought that was quite unique. And I still think that it's quite a unique skill set. And I think one that a lot of people struggle with because you have the artistic world, which doesn't tend to be kind of a systematized way of thinking like a scientific methodology or a lean methodology would be. So it's a very rare mix to be able to kind of incorporate the two worlds. From your perspective, do people tend to be kind of weighted towards one or the other? Are UX designers all this kind of rare breed just by kind of the nature of the role?
That's an interesting question. I suppose one of the things that I always find interesting, you go into different companies and different people have very different perceptions about what UX is. Some people, even within my organization now, people in the product teams, you should have a really deep knowledge of all the different roles and what people are responsible for. Still don't really understand, exactly what a UX person does, what their output is, what they're supposed to be responsible for. And I think the most common, fallacy is people just think UX equals wireframes. And for me, that's like the tip of the iceberg. Wireframes is the final output of a whole lot of other work, thinking, research, workshops, etc. Which actually allows you to then go and create the wireframes. And I think it's kind of quite an old-fashioned view that, the UX person just does, the wireframes. So it's interesting that, people, which you said, you didn't really understand the role of UX. I think there's still an ongoing kind of misunderstanding. And unfortunately, it also perpetuates people just kind of sticking to those kind of quite narrowly defined roles, which are quite traditional. In a lot of organizations, if you're told, if your boss says to you, I need some wireframes, that's what you're going to do. Whereas if they say, I'm looking for a journey map or something more sophisticated, then, I need some user research on this particular group of personas. Then I think, you're kind of setting someone up to kind of do a different kind of piece of work and a more valuable piece of work. So I think, that's the one part of, how people perceive UX. Going forward. I suppose the second part really is, quite often, I think with, UX discipline, one of the other things we found, is that different people in different teams, are unsure exactly how to engage with UX guys. So quite often they will, either, you know, be very prescriptive, as you're saying, and then people come in and say, do this, do that. Or alternatively, you know, they'll expect the UX team to do too much. And I think, you know, that's kind of one of the other kind of misconceptions is like people don't know exactly how to engage with the UX. In terms of, you know, you talked about the characters, you know, different types of people and different approaches, completely aware that, you know, you have a very different mindset when you are a data-led person versus a, you know, more traditional creative. And that's, I think it's been quite a difficult transition for a lot of probably creatives who work in a more traditional way. The concept that, you know, they no longer have the answers. They actually need to get the answers from data. And it's quite a weird evolution of someone who previously it was all about their creativity that kind of made them a great designer. And now it's not, the creativity is almost kind of out the window in a way. It's more about what you can prove with data, you know, through A/B testing or analyzing the data. You know, from my team, you know, one of the things we said, and I was working with obviously the senior guys on my team, but when we were doing a kind of a big recruitment drive, one of the things we said was, you know, we don't actually want rock star designers. And that's not to mean we don't want people to go good at their job, but you know, there's a kind of a traditional creative kind of person who, you know, is quite confident and quite strong in their views and often are very good and very, very kind of, they're confident for a reason. They're very successful designers. They've done lots of really great work. But it's often very, very, you know, opinion led and they kind of the taste maker. And that's what we mean by kind of rock star designers, you know, people who lead on, opinion and, you know, conviction that what they think is right. And really what we want in our team, we always have, you know, been recruiting a particular kind of personality, you know, someone who is, doesn't think they know the right answer. Someone who's very collaborative, you know, so they can work with all the other members of a cross-functional agile team. But someone who does have the right tools, you know, having the right tool set. Like I said, you know, it's not about knowing the answers per se, it's about having the right tools to figure them out. You know? And I think that's really important. I think some people struggle with it to kind of make that transition, and other people just, you know, naturally get excited about it. You know, you spoke a little bit about startups. You know, for me, and I've been involved a little bit in the startup space as well. And, you know, the whole lean approach of product development, you know, is makes so much sense. And it's a smart way of doing things. It's hard to argue with it. And you know, I'd rather just go on, you know, my opinion or someone else's opinion.
It's a brutal way of looking at things, but it's the right way of looking at things, you know, when we're looking at things that potentially impact behaviors to buy more or less of our product at the end of the day. That you know, determines jobs, a whole list of things. So, you know, for an individual to come in and say, I think is a difficult one. And like say, I'm sure from your experiences with hires, that's something that you've had to kind of take into great consideration. And, you know, I think it's just a difficult space to kind of be in, isn't it? I suppose from that perspective, especially if you're kind of very creatively inclined.
Yeah, I think it is. I think what we found quite interesting, kind of said that, you know, it's a difficult space to be in. In our team, what we actually did was we split the role, because originally we had designers who did both UI and UX. We kind of split the role, and we actually took people who were more analytical and made them UX as a UX role, and people who are more kind of creative, and put them into UI roles. And you know, that was actually quite a good split. And I think it works quite well. And I think, you know, I think naturally people who are more creative will tend to fall into the visual design side of things. And people who are maybe more technical and a little bit more analytical, will tend to kind of favor, you know, the UX, the kind of more UX type role. So that's quite, you know, I think it works out well for people in that respect. I think that's kind of generally what's happening with people who either move into it or want to move into this kind of space.
Yeah. Yeah. it's just something to consider, I think. And like you say, I think for, you know, if you consider young people who are considering a career path to go down, for instance, I think, like you say, there's so many misconceptions about UX, you know, before they get into it. And never mind before you get into it. And then during, while you're actually in a team, internally, it's confusing. What do you think that, you know, kind of what's your approach to have, you know, kind of more transparency?
I guess, I mean, the simplest thing is just talking to people a lot, trying to explain to them either through, you know, presentations or just kind of face-to-face meetings, you know, what the roles are, how they should be engaged effectively. And it's also kind of been up, you know, up to the team and themselves as well to slightly evangelize what the role is and how they should, you know, why it's important and how it kind of adds value to the business.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's kind of the transparency. I don't think necessarily verticals, but, you know, what kind of other teams do you collaborate with the most, for example?
So in terms of UX, we actually work across a very broad set of teams. So we have, you know, the main UX, you know, collaboration happens between the UX team and the product development teams. So we'll do a lot of work together with product owners and the business analysts. And obviously, you know, during the build, we'll work a lot with the technical team as well. That's kind of the core, set of people that we engage with. However, you know, within the business, there's loads of other, stakeholders in different teams. And, you know, for example, our business is very regulated as well. So we quite often will engage with, you know, compliance or legal team, to make sure that what we're doing is correct, get advice from them. We also have a publishing team, a marketing team, CRM team, a trading team, a customer service team. You know, there's loads, a finance team. There's loads and loads and loads of kind of slightly more siloed teams who have very specific functions within the business. And on occasion we need to engage with them. Quite often, you know, the trading and publishing teams are a very kind of critical piece of the experience. So quite often we'll need to engage with them quite deeply when we are either doing some work or if they need some work doing, in order to bring a new product to market or, you know, maintaining an existing product. And that kind of also, you know, interface a lot with, you know, them and product teams, and there might be senior stakeholders in the business as well who, you know, have specific initiatives they're trying to get off the ground.
Interesting. And I think that's kind of the fun thing as well about kind of what you do. You know, I suppose to that point, what is it that kind of continually keeps you engaged and motivated and excited about kind of what you do? I mean, that's obviously one part of it, is the fun. I think from my perspective, it's kind of the fun of collaboration with so many different teams, which is probably, you know, much more so than most.
I think, strangely, I mean, the collaboration is fun and interesting. Sometimes it's quite difficult, because sometimes you have to, you know, collaborate with stakeholders or teams who have a completely different point of view, or as you were saying, you know, they have lots of opinions and they're not so, you know, sold into the concept of data-led approach, particularly when they have, you know, very strong subject matter expertise. So that's, always, you know, a little bit of a challenge. But, you know, the thing that really excites me is actually creating the products. There's something really rewarding about creating products and building products and getting into consumers' hands. And I think, you know, from a UX point of view, you know, when you work in a business, a large business that's got like a lot of scale, like we have, what you end up finding is that, you know, a small little change can make a huge difference, you know, financially to the business. And that's really, you know, that's really quite exciting as well. Equally, you know, a small mistake can cost the business millions as well. So, it's thrilling in some ways and fun in others.
Yeah, I got everything though. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's kind of one of them spaces where, it seems like it would be easier than most to kind of, you know, keep engaged But I suppose that just depends on the organization. If you're with an organization that's constantly motivated to bring out new products, then it's fantastic. You know, but then I suppose an organization that's not as motivated, it must be much more difficult to kind of stay motivated, engaged. Is it, you know, that for you that's kind of motivating? It's like the constant change in the product, you know, new products, or is it just, you know, what about it? Kind of that side of things, is it?
I think it's kind of two things. I think, you know, that every organization, even if their products aren't new all the time, there's going to be an evolution of products. You know, there's always UX, you know, optimization work to be done. There's always A/B testing that can be done, and, you know, things change over time. So I'd be surprised if there's an organization where the products don't, you know, continually evolve. In terms of new products, you know, they're always fun to work on as well. I think it's equally rewarding having, you know, getting a new product into someone's hands. You know, probably maybe it's a little bit more exciting, but, you know, it's no less rewarding, you know, optimizing, you know, making a really great onboarding flow, or, you know, optimizing a particular journey for an existing product and seeing the difference and changes, than it is, you know, doing something from scratch. In fact, sometimes it's nice to go back and refine an existing piece of work that's been done, or existing product, you know, kind of continually improve it. You know, that sometimes that can be more challenging than just designing something kind of as kind of a green field, start from new projects.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. And, you know, obviously kind of transitioning and progressing through your career, you would have got at some point had that point of inflection where you took on more of a management type role. You know, kind of what challenges were associated with that for you, and how did that sort of, you know, come about initially?
Yeah, so I've actually done a lot of managerial roles, and I've done a lot of hands-on roles after being managerial roles. So I've kind of dipped in and out, if that makes sense. And I think when I first started doing managerial roles, I'm pretty confident that my approach wasn't quite right. You know, I think most people when they are new managers tend to become managers because they're very good at what they do. Not that I was necessarily very good, but, I was very, you know, particular about how I like to have things done and the kind of quality of the work I was doing. And when you become a manager, you tend to, you know, want to, put those views onto the people that report to you. And sometimes, you know, I'm pretty confident that I did, in my early days, of being a manager, is kind of completely over-manage, micromanage, particularly in the design side of things. You know, people need space to breathe a little bit, and they need to kind of make their own mistakes. And I think as you evolve as a manager, you slowly learn to let go more and more, and let things not be absolutely perfect. I know that sounds like a slightly weird thing to say, but you know, you need to give people space to make their own mistakes and to learn and to kind of grow. If you keep kind of catching them when you can see something going wrong, you know, it's not actually helpful to them. And it can be quite demoralizing as well. You know, I don't think anyone likes to be kind of micromanaged. So, you know, I think as I've kind of matured in that role, I have, you know, gradually, you know, I try to treat people more like adults as much as possible. And they're expecting them to act like adults. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the biggest things I've learned, I guess, over time in terms of management. And like I said, you know, I've dipped back in on a number of occasions back into very kind of hands-on work and less managerial. It's quite interesting having been on both sides. And I still quite enjoy making stuff. You know, I love doing hands-on work.
Yeah.
Something I find quite often when I'm doing hands-on work is, I sit there and smile to myself because I can't believe I'm being paid to do something that's so much fun. So I find it really rewarding. I think everyone does, you know, everyone from when they're young, you know, everyone likes creating pictures and making stuff out of clay. And for me, you know, creating design and product, design and UX work, it's kind of like that process. You know, you have something that you produced at the end of it. That's always quite rewarding, and good fun to do, you know, and see something kind of come to life. So I quite enjoy getting back into hands-on work. Some people are a bit funny about, feel like they're taking a step back or they're not progressing, but, I don't see it like that at all. I think it's important to, maintain skill levels in both in terms of, your management skills and also in terms of your kind of hands-on work.
I think it's that idea of servant leadership, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. I think that definitely sounds like a good approach. And I think, in my experience, there's a mixture of ways you engage with the people you manage. Sometimes it's you let them get on with what they're doing. Sometimes you get very involved. Sometimes they need support, sometimes not so much. It's kind of gauging, as you say, what the right way is to help people kind of progress. But I think it's really important to, help people learn stuff and learn stuff on their own and kind of evolve their own skills. And I think that's a really important part of, teach people why something makes sense rather than just saying do it like this or do it like that.
But yeah, I'm conscious of the time as well here, mate. But, kind of a nice thing to finish on, I suppose, is, technology wise, kind of, from your own personal experiences, or stuff you're working on as well, kind of what are you kind of most excited to see, happen in kind of the world of technology and things that may impact kind of your world?
There's one thing which is absolutely exciting, so much so that I'm teaching myself Python in my spare time, obviously, which is the world of AI, which everyone's obviously talking about at the moment. For me, it just holds so much promise and disruption, and it's going to be really interesting. I think in terms of, what's going to happen in the future, AI is going to form an increasingly important part of everything we do. And people are talking about, replacing 30% of our current jobs are going to be replaced by AI, including, complicated knowledge, jobs, even things like doctors, etc. So for me, that's the most exciting thing on the horizon right now. I imagine the hype is a little bit further ahead than the reality of what we actually have. But I think it will be one of those things that everyone gets really excited about, and then it'll go a little bit quiet because it's not happening quite as fast as everyone expected. And then all of a sudden, one day, it'll just be there. A little bit like the kind of mobile phone, kind of started off, the phones weren't great. And then everyone got used to them, and then they had a couple of different types of phones. And then all of a sudden, the iPhone came out and it had these amazing touch screens and, internet on your phone. It's kind of like a big leap forward. And almost, if you look at someone on an iPhone and you go back, maybe 10 years prior to that, that was the kind of stuff you'd see on Star Trek, touch screens and people swiping things and walking around with tablets. It's almost straight out of sci-fi. I think it's almost like, people didn't notice it happening. All of a sudden it was just there. And I think that the same thing will probably happen with AI, where we'll know about it and it'll be a not very good version of it. And then all of a sudden, one day we're going to wake up and everything's going to work really, really well. And the AI is going to be doing, 90% of what we need in terms of, working, being doctors, analyzing stuff, designing things. They've already got, they already have AI programs that design music and images and things like that. So, it's quite an interesting space to kind of see where it's all going to end up.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.